Catherine Teagan Books and Harper Audio present Nine Liars by Maureen Johnson. Performed by Kate Rudd. A note before we begin. To see the maps that accompany this book, be sure to download the accompanying enhancement PDF from your audiobook provider. Or go directly to www.harpercollins.com/pages/9liars. For Jillian Pensavalli and Patrick Hines, who would never go to the murder mansion in the countryside. June 23rd, 1995. 9:30 p.m.
Julian is an arse, Suze said. A world-class, unmitigated arse.
Suze Rillington took full advantage of her spot in the front seat of the Volvo. She stretched out her 6-foot-tall frame, allowing the world at large to behold her abs, which were neatly exposed by a sports bra she pretended was a shirt. There wasn't much of an audience at present, aside from maybe a few sparrows or wood pigeons in the trees along the road. But if they were interested in human abs, they were in for a treat. They had gotten a late start from Cambridge, but English summer days stretch on for miles.
There was still plenty of golden light spilling down on the country lane in Gloucester, even at this late hour.
The sky was clear now, but there was a vertical line of gunmetal clouds in the distance. It would rain soon. This was England. There was always rain in the future.
A Titanic arse, Suze continued. That sinks all who ride it.
The remarks were directed at Rosie Mortimer, who was paying no attention. She was looking through the open window of the car, reaching out her fingers to gently brush the hedgerows. Her blonde pigtails flapped in the breeze, slapping her face. She didn't seem to notice or care. Rosie was not the quiet type, so this distracted silence of hers threw off the usual chemistry.
We know, Yash said.
Yash Varma was about as tall as Suze, but also had unfailing good manners and had ceded the front seat to her.
Why were you with him for the better part of 2 years if he's such an arse, Suze?
Because he also has a world-class arse.
From the driver's seat, Sebastian Holt Carey nodded at this.
Undeniably true on all counts, he said. Our Julian is in all ways arse.
Sebastian checked the rearview mirror to make sure he hadn't lost the beat-up Volkswagen Golf that was following them. It had vanished from view for a moment, but soon reappeared. There were 5 people in this car, the Volvo, and another 4 in the Golf, weaving their way through the hedgerows. 9 in total. Not just any 9. The 9. Greater than the sum of their parts.
Sebastian, Theodora, Yash, Peter, Suze, Angela, Julian, Rosie, and Noel.
They require introduction. They were Sebastian Holt Carey, future 6th Viscount Holt Carey, the Lord of the Manor, quick-witted and big-hearted, with a taste for glam and goth and boys who liked glam and goth. He slid through Cambridge on a trail of red wine, charm, and a title, squeaked by with a 3rd in chemistry, and missed out on last place in the exams, which bothered him.
You'd think he was passed out or not paying attention, and then he'd bring the house down with a single comment.
Tremendously good at playing intense people and improving scenes. Never at a loss for words. Rosie Mortimer, a pocket-sized Irish student, barely 5 feet tall, but with the voice and personality of someone 5 times that size, and a laugh that made the walls shake. An unstoppable force. A bit dramatic, perhaps. But that's what's called for in a drama group. Always willing to take things to the maximum level, once threw a mug of tea at a policeman. Suze Rillington. Big, doe-like eyes, legs for miles, and the confidence of 10 mediocre men. A brilliant mind for Shakespeare and masterful impressionist. The one who would take off all her clothes on the slightest provocation and run down the road laughing.
Go on, give her a reason.
Noel Butler. Tall and thin, all angles and nerves and cigarette smoke. He favored vintage 70s clothes, Not fancy ones, but proper charity shop ones. Big glasses, wide-collared shirts, wide-gauge corduroy jackets, the best straight man a comedy group could have.
Peter Elmore,
the natural athlete who had no interest in rowing or chasing a ball. Lanky, with reddish-blonde hair that was always an inch longer than he wanted it, and heavy-lidded eyes.
Technically, he was a student of modern political theory.
In reality, he was a walking database of jokes and gags and the history of comedy. Perhaps the most determined of the group to break into the business. Most likely to burn down the kitchen trying to make toast.
Yash Varma, the other comedy nerd.
Obsessed since childhood with all things funny. Sat in front of the TV, transcribing shows by hand to study the patterns and learn how to write. The only person in the group who could possibly take on Peter in terms of comedy knowledge, which was why the two had decided to merge their brains and form a writing pair.
The most romantic of the group, with an easily broken heart.
Julian Reynolds. The beautiful one with the soulful eyes and the long lashes. The trouble. Tourists asked him to stand with them in pictures for no reason aside from the fact that he was a Cambridge student, or English, or simply there. Irritatingly gifted as a performer. The full package. Could act, could sing, could play the guitar. The one who never raised his voice, ever. He never had to. Everyone leaned forward to hear what he had to say. His little town up north couldn't contain him. Most of the nine would grudgingly admit he was often the only reason people came to their shows. Angela Gill, the history student from Leeds, the quiet one, until she wasn't, cried with homesickness for the first three nights at Cambridge until she met Suze at a mixer. She wrote her sketches alone, often with a gin and tonic in a mug on her desk and a cigarette dangling from her lips. Detail-oriented, conscientious, and the only one who ever used the washing machine properly.
Theodora Bailey.
Without question, the academic of the group. A medical student from Notting Hill in London, the one who planned on using her degree, the one who fixed you up after a long night, the director, the one who figured it all out. As a black woman at Cambridge, the one who had to deal with the looks, the muttered remarks, and the remarks said right to her face about the color of her skin, usually locked hip to hip with Sebastian.
The nine, going off on a final adventure in two cars down a country road late on a June night. The trouble with Julian, Suze went on.
Oh, God. Yash put his hands over his face. Enough. We've talked about Julian nonstop for 3 years. Let's call a moratorium this week, all right?
How do we not talk about him when he's right there?
He's not here now, in this car.
I just want Rosie to know she did the right thing.
You know that, don't you, Rose? I did the same myself when he did it to me.
He's a cheat. He's rotten. One of us should have killed him a long time ago. Rosie maintained her distracted silence, her brow furrowed in thought.
We're close, aren't we? Theo said.
Theo was the fifth passenger in the car, squeezed between Yash and Rosie. In the middle of everything, as usual. This attempt to redirect the conversation fooled no one, but it had an effect.
About 10 minutes away, darlings,
Sebastian replied.
Suze accepted that the topic had been adjourned and reached into a bag of cheese and onion crisps. She found that there was nothing but crumbs left and crushed the empty bag into the pocket of her tracksuit bottoms. Or someone's tracksuit bottoms. Possibly Peter's, as they were long, and Peter was both tall and one of the few people in the house with any sportswear. In their house at Cambridge, the laundry would get mixed together, and clothes slowly became communal property. If you didn't take your shirt off the drying rack fast enough, it would be claimed by someone else.
Here, Suze said, reaching into her purse and producing 5 large black sleeves of photographs.
Forgot to show you these. Pictures from the last 2 weeks. I picked them up yesterday. She passed the photos to the passengers in the back seat.
Are you still getting free developing from that guy at Boots? Theo asked. Is that what they're calling it these days? Sebastian said.
Suze playfully swatted him, almost causing him to drive the car into a hedge.
I can't help it if he likes me, and it saved me almost 20 quid.
The photos roused Rosie from her reverie. She reached for one of the packs. For a few minutes, conversation ceased as the passengers in the back looked at the photos. Sebastian steered the massive Volvo through the twisting lanes, and Suze fiddled with the radio. There was music. There was sunset birdsong. There were probably more crisps somewhere in the car, and all was right in the world. Sebastian turned through an opening in the hedgerow that was barely wide enough to accommodate the car, then made his way down a pitted dirt path through the trees. They had reached a tall iron gate, the only break in an ivy-covered brick wall.
"Who's going to get out and open it?"
Sebastian said.
"I'll do it," Yash said, popping open his door.
"The code is 19387. Pull the right gate toward you a bit. It sticks. Hold it for the others. It closes quickly."
Yash did so, holding the gate so both the Volvo and the Golf could pass. They proceeded onward, down a peaceful drive arched by trees that created a lush hall of greenery, with slender beams of late-day sun poking through. This was England at its finest. The 100-acre wood, the magical forest, the green and pleasant land of yore.
"Have to go slow," Sebastian said. "Chester is hard of hearing. It would be a bad start to the week if I ran over our beloved gardener while he was standing on the drive."
"Might make a good sketch," Yash said.
"You run over the gardener, but then still keep trying to have a weekend party like nothing happened."
"That's not a good sketch," Theo said.
Yash considered for a moment.
"No," he said, "it's not. Well, maybe with some polish on the idea. Remind me to mention it to Peter. We still have one sketch to write for Edinburgh."
"You are not working this week," Suze said.
"We have to," Yash replied. "At least a little. This is the fringe festival we're writing for, Suze, not the usual knobheads at the pub. Peter thinks that—"
"I don't care what Peter thinks. No, working this week. Sebastian, do something."
"If you think I can stop Peter and Yash on their quest for comedy glory," Sebastian said to her, "you have more faith in me than I deserve."
"Theo?"
"I am but one woman," Theo replied. "I cannot perform miracles."
They made the final turn of the drive, breaking out of the woods. Suddenly they were surrounded by walls of hydrangeas in hypnotic shades of electric blue and violet. Around them there were pergolas and paths wound with wisteria, and rose bushes with peach-colored blooms that stood on point. The air was full of the smell of lilacs that trapped the raindrops and released their perfume into the air. Merryweather was before them. A sprawling creation of sand-colored stone, flat-fronted and hip-roofed, with a columned portico. Ivy and flowering vines crept up the house, an organic coat to soften the solidness of the building. A stone terrace wrapped around the house, lined with urns and statuary. A glass orangery jutted from the far side of the building, filled with potted trees. Out the front, a long apron of green rolled down to an ornamental pond with a folly. The rest of the grounds were quilted in a pattern of walled brick gardens and paths.
"It's always absurd to me that this is your house," Suze said.
"Well, I'm an absurd person," Sebastian replied. "Half of it is falling down anyway. We use the lesser staff to hold up the roof."
The journey ended on the gravel drive, next to a garage on the side of the house. Rosie bolted from the car, walking off a few paces. Suze and Sebastian got out to stretch and have a cigarette, while Theo and Yash set about unpacking the car.
"Rosie's having a hard time of it,"
Sebastian said quietly.
"Yes," Suze said, accepting a cigarette that was offered.
"Also, did you see the way Yash elbowed Peter out of the way to ride with us?"
"Hard to miss. Do you think this will be the week one of them finally makes a move? It's now or never. Maybe we need to take action. Lock them in the attic together."
"I like that," Suze said,
watching as Yash almost fell over himself trying to lift the heaviest of the bags, even though Theo was more than capable. "Too bad you don't have a dungeon."
"The dungeon is for my private use, darling. But perhaps I can make an exception for a good cause."
"If Yash was busy shagging, he couldn't be working."
"Don't bet on that,"
Sebastian said.
"Anyway, Peter would carry on. You know our ambitious boy can't be stopped. He'd sit by the bedroom door with a notebook and write down any awkward sexual remarks Yash made.
Oh, God. That could actually happen. They would turn it into a sketch.
Are you two planning on helping at any point?
Yash called out as he pulled Suze's suitcase from the car.
No,
Suze and Sebastian said in unison.
Just checking,
Yash said, nodding. The Golf poodled up and parked. Four more people extracted themselves from it, far more crushed and rumpled than the passengers of the commodious Volvo. Peter, who had been riding in the passenger seat with a map in case the group got lost, popped out, beating a happy rhythm on the roof of the car. Noel, the driver, unfolded himself from the driver's seat. He placed another in an endless series of cigarettes between his lips, lit it, and stretched his arms above his head.
Bloody hell, he said.
He didn't elaborate. The remark might have been about the drive, the mansion and grounds spread out around them, or life in general. Angela and Julian had to be released from the back seat, where they had been packed in with suitcases and assorted bags. Angela crawled out from the space, clinging to her bag, her clothes sweaty and wrinkled. Julian emerged from the other side, looking just as warm and sweat-glazed, but he wore sweat well, and the warmth only loosened his gait. Nature had gifted him pool-water blue eyes, a tiny gap between his two front teeth that rendered every smile a heartwarming, aw-shucks vibe, and an overall symmetry in every feature that resonated deeply and pleasingly with all who looked upon him. No amount of time crushed into the back of a Volkswagen under a pile of luggage diminished his appearance.
We made good time, Julian said. It didn't take that long.
Angela, who had dropped down onto the gravel of the drive and was flapping her shirt to air out her chest, groaned in reply.
Picture, Suze said. Picture now. We'll do it here.
There were several protests from the group, but Suze waved them away.
I want pictures of this whole week, every moment. This is our arrival picture. Come on, everyone over here.
She motioned for her friends to come over to join her at the edge of the gravel drive by a nondescript outbuilding.
In front of the woodshed? Sebastian asked. Very scenic.
I can put the camera on the car if we do it here. Quick, before we lose all the light.
While the others got into position, Suze set the camera on the roof of the car and hit the timer button. She ran to get into frame. Once the photo was taken, they lugged their bags through the gate into the kitchen garden, down the outside passage that was built so that the servants could lug wood and coal and supplies without disturbing the tranquility of the back garden. Great estates are like Disney World, designed to look effortless, with the labor going on behind a bit of decoration. When they reached the back door, Sebastian unlocked it, admitting them to a capacious mudroom filled with wellies and rain slickers.
Rooms, then game,
Sebastian shouted. Yash dropped his bags first and took off running. The race for rooms was on. Angela, Peter, Julian, Suze, and Theo ripped through the kitchen and the maze of small back rooms. Some took the back stairs, while others headed for the main hall. From there, they scrambled up the grand staircase, ignoring the looks from the Holt Careys of the past, who stared at them from paintings on the wall. Meriwether had 16 bedrooms, but some had four posters, and others their own bathrooms. They were all good in their own way, but everything was a game and a competition. So they slid down the hallways, slipping on the highly polished wood, pressing each other good-naturedly out of the way to claim rooms they might not even have wanted. Sebastian did not run. It was his house, and his room was fixed. After setting down his things in the mudroom and stretching for a moment, he went to the kitchen, removed the bottle of champagne that was always chilling in the refrigerator, and popped it open. He poured the contents into a pint glass and gazed out the window over the sink. This one had a view into the kitchen garden, which was lush with shaggy clusters of mint, blue-flowering borage, and strawberry plants, heavy with bright red fruit. There was something else in the garden, along with the bountiful plants and the cold frames. Over by the wall, Rosie and Noel were conferring. They had not yet come inside and were pressed close together, tall Noel leaning down to bend his ear to Rosie's lips. He was leaning low enough that he kept having to slide his massive glasses back up on his nose. Whatever they were talking about, it was intensely private, and Rosie occasionally turned to look up at the windows above. This was an interesting development, Sebastian thought. Something to be watched. Upstairs, Sebastian heard something large fall over. There was no cacophony of falling objects, so not a cabinet. A side table, then. Possibly the little mahogany one with the marble inlay. It was sturdy. It would survive. Besides, he thought, sipping his pint of champagne contently, things were bound to be broken this weekend. There was no getting around it. 1.
Dear Miss Bell, I have been reading about your recent success in solving cold cases, like the ones at Ellingham Academy and at Camp Sunny Pines. There is something going on in my town, and I need your help getting to the bottom of it. My neighbor has been killing people in an industrial dryer and putting their remains in our community garden. I have tried to dig up the garden myself, but I am not permitted inside due to a legal matter, and it is very hard to do with a small shovel. Can you come here and help me to...
Stevie Bell stopped reading. It was a quiet October night in Minerva House. At the farmhouse table in its cozy common room, she sat with her friends. Janelle Franklin and Vi Harper-Tomo were side by side working on their laptops. You finished your Stanford essay, right? Janelle asked Vi. Almost, Vi replied. Are you using that same one for Tufts? Vi looked up. They had gotten a new pair of white glasses over the summer and had cropped their hair and bleached it to almost the same shade, with a fade of blue down the back of their head. They were wearing a massive blue and silver fuzzy sweater that sort of matched their hair. Janelle had embraced the fall palette in an orange sweater and a vibrant kente cloth head wrap in gold, red, and green. No, Vi said. I'm writing one in Japanese for Tufts, and I'm not done with that one either.
Let me know when you're finished so I can input it into the spreadsheet.
Janelle and Vi had become a couple from the moment they'd met at the start of last year. They had decided that they didn't want to go to the same school, probably, but they wanted to go to schools that were close to each other. In True Crime Talk, they had done a geographical profile of the unsub, worked out exactly what they wanted from their schools, and targeted the regions, then the programs. Every night, Janelle updated the spreadsheet that tracked where they were in their mutual application process. Next to this, Nate Fisher was also typing away furiously, his face a scowl of concentration. Nate was one of Stevie's closest friends. Lanky. The kind of pale the Victorians would have classified as consumptive, with his never-cool t-shirts and his wrong-sized pants hiding an athletic build. A fringe of overgrown brown hair half-shaded his eyes as he bent over his computer. He was usually her companion in avoiding things, but tonight he was letting her down. His fingers hadn't stopped moving all night. Stevie was supposed to be working. She had 6 articles to read tonight for modern American political history. When your class only had 5 people in it, you couldn't get away with not doing the reading. You can only vamp so long about the media in general until your teacher raises a practiced eyebrow and puts the imaginary cone of shame on your head. She looked at the article on her screen. Defining bias, how we interpret what we read. The sound of Nate's typing echoed in her ears. He had headphones on and his fingers were flying. She had never seen him work this hard. Nate was a writer. He had gotten into Ellingham on the strength of a novel he wrote and published in his early teens. Since that time, he had been running from deadlines and the concept of writing in general like it was an angry bear on an electric bike. Where had he found all this focus? Maybe from the fact that it was October, senior year. How had she gotten here? Well, time does that. The clock ticks steadily on. Time was ticking right now. She had to read. This was the shortest of the 6 articles. She knew that because for the last hour she had scrolled through all 6, looking at how long they were and figuring out what to read first. Then she would go to the little kitchen off to the side of the common room and get some more water, or a hot chocolate. Or she went to pee. Or she walked to her room to get a hoodie. Or she walked to her room to get her slippers. Or she just stared at the moose head with the holiday lights on it that was mounted above the fireplace. The rest of her time, she looked at her phone, which was how she'd found this new message about the shovel and the industrial dryer. Time to work. Okay. She would do it this time. She would read. Her sightless gaze dribbled down the first paragraph. She tapped Nate under the table with her foot.
What?
Nate said, pulling off his headphones. Do you want to go for a walk? Stevie said. Go over to the dining hall and get some cake? Nate glanced at his screen, looked back at his friend, and sighed.
Fine, he said, but only because I love cake.
Stevie sagged with relief when he agreed. She had been dangerously close to almost reading three entire sentences. Fall nights in Vermont were crisp. The air had an edge to it that snapped you awake. There was a general crunchiness to everything. Leaves, frosted grass, cold gravel pathways. When you stepped on a stick, it sounded like a firecracker going off under your foot. And every pile of organic detritus rustled with some life form. The moon tonight was full and huge. A massive yellow eye suspended overhead, casting its gaze down on the mountaintop.
You get any new ones today?
Nate asked. Visions. Industrial dryer. Community garden.
It's been a while since you got a vision.
It's a nice change from everyone who has a neighbor who gets a boat and an oversized cooler, Stevie said. A lot of people buy boats and coolers. Only, like, half of them are serial killers.
How many of these messages are you getting now?
Just a few a week, she said. Maybe 10.
That's still a lot of people who want you to solve their weird crap.
They don't want me to solve anything, Stevie replied. They want to tell me about something they saw, and everyone sees stuff. There's nothing to do. I'm just itchy.
I'm aware. This is what you're like when you don't have something to work on. It's not great. Once it gets dark and you've already talked to David, you basically turn into a zombie. Which is why I'm out here walking with you now, to keep you from eating the sheep.
I'm not going to eat a sheep, Stevie replied. Maybe an owl, though.
Crunchy, hollow owl bones. Delicious owl meat.
Or a moose, if I ever see one. They reached the central green in front of the Great House, the school's administrative heart. The green was the wide oval of pristine lawn that rolled out in front of the building. With a marble fountain depicting the god Neptune at the top and a cupola at the bottom. Normally, there was nothing but open space in the middle. But one of the new students, a girl improbably named Valve, who'd grown up on a farm sanctuary and wore at least 7 crystals at all times, had introduced 3 sheep to the school. They meandered around the grounds, but preferred the green. They noodled around under the moonlight, largely in the vicinity of the little wooden structure that had been erected for them. Free-range sheep might be a strange sight at most schools, but this was not most schools. This was Ellingham Academy. Ellingham was in the mountains of Vermont. Its story was the stuff of legend, its reputation gold-plated, its illustrious graduates legion. Its story was long, but can best be summarized thusly. Famous rich guy, Albert Ellingham, climbs a mountain in the roaring 1920s, gets loopy from the limited oxygen, decides to build his dream school, a place where learning is a game. He even decides to build himself a massive mansion in the middle of said school, so he can be a part of the whole process. He dynamites the face off the mountain and empties his bottomless pocketbook, building the most elaborate and fantastic campus. Yale and Princeton would bite their ivy-covered knuckles in jealousy over the red and gold bricks, tree-lined paths, sculptures, twee-twisting pathways, and Gothic spires. Albert Ellingham declared that his school would have no admissions criteria. Students applied in whatever way they thought was right and expressed their passion. If the school chose you, the experience was free for 2 years, which was the length of the program. The school would design bespoke learning experiences for each student. Only 50 students were accepted each year. It was competitive. It was egalitarian. It was forward-thinking. It was perfect in all ways except for the murders. Murders, plural. Some had occurred in 1936, when Ellingham's wife and daughter were kidnapped and a student killed. This turned into one of the great crimes of the 20th century. Stevie had gotten into Ellingham with the stated purpose of solving this case. The other murders had been more recent, just 1 year ago. Last year at Ellingham had been, as the administration called it, a time of challenges. That was a polite way of saying, we had a minor murder spree and a mass evacuation. This explained why the incoming class all seemed a bit on the nervous or excited side. They were jumpy. Stevie topped off this experience by working on another cold case on her summer break, this one in Massachusetts and dating from the 1970s. This should have gotten her a pass on reading something like Defining Bias, How We Interpret What We Read. But that is not the way the world works, because the world didn't care what she did last year, or last month, or even earlier tonight when she had bravely tried to read three sentences. If the world is feeling super charitable, it might take a passing glance at what you are doing now. What matters is what you are doing next. And high school was nothing if not about the next box you had to check.
You hate it when Vi and Janelle work on their spreadsheet, Nate said. It freaks you out every time.
This was true. It was October in her last year of high school, and Stevie's entire college plan so far consisted of 7 bookmarked pictures on Instagram, 3 browser windows she never closed, and a notebook page that contained insights such as science and where is it? Because college meant majors. It meant knowing who you were and where you wanted to go in life. It meant figuring out how smart you really were. And would you be as smart as everyone else at your imaginary school? Should you go somewhere you were the smartest? Should you go somewhere tiny or to a huge university that filled a city? College also meant money, and money was confusing. She had a little now, enough for small things, and maybe a semester somewhere if she used it all at once. The rest would have to come from somewhere. Loans, scholarships. Her parents didn't have it, that was for sure. The only reason she could go to Ellingham was because it was free. So, to counter Nate's entirely justified remark, she responded with a question. You never mention where you're applying, she said. What have you been doing for college stuff?
I'm working on it, he said. I've done some applications.
Where to?
Different places. I'm still working it out. But you have to start, and I know you haven't even really looked yet. You can't avoid it forever.
What are you, the college police? She asked.
I'm just saying,
he went on.
You've been genuinely spaced, and that shit is going to be due soon. You have to pick some places, any places. Start filling out applications. There are first years here who have some of that stuff ready to go. Even David did it.
He had invoked Stevie's far-off boyfriend a second time. This was a direct jab at her.
Sounded like you were getting a lot of writing done, Stevie replied.
Yeah, I am.
This confident yeah was both direct and squirrely, and it attracted Stevie's interest.
Yeah?
Yeah, he replied. I am. I'm writing. I write.
No, you don't, Stevie said. I mean, you do, but mostly you don't. Are you working on the second book? Is it going well?
It's fine, he said dismissively. We're not talking about my book.
We kind of are.
Stevie, he said. You're turning into that person, the one with the long-distance partner. Do you want to be a girlfriend?
These were fighting words.
Work on one of these dumb cases, he went on. Why not look into this thing with the dryer and the garden? Do something.
Stevie had no defense. They mutually decided to stop talking and went to the dining hall in silence, filled their reusable, Ellingham-issued takeout containers with cake and other sustenance, and walked back out under the big yellow moon. Nate was right. All she needed, really, was a little murder, not a big one. A little something to take the edge off. And not a neighbor with a dryer and a shovel. A real one. There were so many murders out there. Surely she could have one. June 23rd, 1995. 10:30 p.m. In the lilac room. No four-poster, but a private bath with a clawfoot tub and climbing roses all around the window. Angela Gill unpacked her things. And they were actually her things. Unlike the other nine, Angela was always careful not to take things that were not hers, or if she did, to give them back washed and folded. She set her reading on her bedside stand. Just because she had graduated didn't mean there was any less to do. She was about to start work at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and she had to become an expert in Tudor textiles and clothing as quickly as possible. Somewhere down the hall, someone was already blasting music. Blur. That was probably Noel. The response came at once from another room, louder. That was Sue's, replying with Oasis. There was constant debate in their house about which was the better band. The battle had been brought to Merriweather, turning it into a Britpop echo chamber. Angela opened the window, sticking her face out to smell the fresh country air and the flowers outside. The view wasn't as grand as that from some of the other rooms. It overlooked a walled kitchen garden. But it was pleasant enough, and the air was sweet. The cloud cover had caught up with them, and the first grumblings of a summer thunderstorm shook the sky. This was it. This was really, really it. The last week together. Her friends. How would she live without them? The rest of the world was going to be so lonely. Cambridge University is made up of a collection of colleges under the umbrella of a university. And the nine came from different ones and varied fields of study. They would not have met at all if not for a shared love of theater and a series of auditions in their first weeks. They had varied levels of success at these auditions, but they recognized something in each other immediately. Group friendships are products of the right time. The chemistry of season, activity, emotion, and random occurrence. They coalesced over a series of long nights at the pub, in rehearsal spaces, cafes, and bedrooms. It was Yash who first proposed that they form a sketch comedy group. Theo kept the topic going and made it all come together. By the end of the first term, the decision was made and the lineup solidified. They had gone through a series of names in those first weeks. Danger Gran, Basket of Rats, The Toast Killers, No Fun Before Bedtime. Those kinds of names were popular for student comedy groups, some kind of weird phrase. Right before their first show, it was time to come to a decision, which meant a trip to the pub, many bags of crisps, and hours of discussion. Over the last round, Rosie was sober enough to count and find that there were nine of them. "We should be the nine," she said, clearly having had enough of the meandering debate.
"The nine what?" Yash had asked.
"Just..." Rosie considered her empty pint glass. "The nine. That's it. It's different from all these other names. It's simple. Monolithic. Like Blur or Pulp or Suede."
It was late, they were all a bit drunk, and they needed something for the flyer by morning. The nine it was. From that point on, you never saw one of the nine without at least one of the others. In the summer before their final year, Angela found the perfect house. A student rental with nine minuscule bedrooms, three bathrooms with questionable plumbing, a kitchen with only two working burners on the stove, and signs of recent fire damage in the lounge. It was farther out from town, so getting to lectures required long bike rides, bus trips, or perhaps a ride in one of the two cars owned by members of the group. But it fit nine people, even if that fit was snug, and there seemed a small but not impossible chance of the whole structure going up in flames. Best of all, it had a muddy walled garden out the back that led down to the river. This became the featured spot at their house parties, and the saggy and half-rotted picnic table served as a dining surface when the sun was out, and often when it wasn't. Sue's strung some outdoor fairy lights and garlands of fabric flowers for some party and never took them down. Ditto for the two floppy camping tents that Peter bought for a festival. This was the kingdom of the nine, and it was all coming to an end. When this week was over, everything was over, so the party had to rage on as intensely and as long as possible. There was a knock at the door, and Peter appeared with his sleepy-eyed smile.
"Lost my lighter in the car," he said. "Can I use yours?"
All of the nine were smokers except for Theo and Yash, Angela planned to give it up after this week. It's in my bag, the blue one on the bed. Peter went over to the bag and fished out the lighter. He put the cigarette between his lips and joined her at the large window.
Any chance you want to help us run some scenes this week?
Peter asked, striking a light.
We're supposed to be relaxing,
Angela reminded him. This is a party, remember?
Sure, but there'll be time.
Peter always had his eye on the future. Only he and Yash planned on making an actual career out of comedy, which was not known for being the most stable of livelihoods. She never doubted they would make it, though. They were fantastic writers, and they never stopped working. She was a writer as well, but she never felt like she could keep up with the two of them. Well, she was a historian, really. A researcher. That was her calling.
Or maybe she had failed.
She just didn't have their commitment.
If you wanted to be funny, you needed to be deadly serious about it.
She sat on the windowsill and leaned out a bit farther to let the cool air brush her face.
Careful, Peter said. I don't think we're supposed to be falling out the windows this early in the week.
Remember that time, Angela said, that Yash fell out that second-story window while trying to make a girl laugh.
The Spider-Man impression.
What college was she from, Kings?
Pembroke,
Peter replied.
His ribs still hurt him. I don't think those breaks healed properly.
Breaks never do they? I broke my wrist when I was a child. It's always been a bit funny.
Peter was looking at her curiously. She had the light, tingling feeling like he was about to kiss her. It made sense that this might happen now. They had never come together romantically in the last 3 years. It was one of the few couplings that hadn't come up. The Nine tended to date internally and reconfigure themselves regularly. To keep up with their love lives, you needed a chart. Julian and Suze were tied for most romantically active within the group. Along with her two stints with Julian, Suze had dated Peter for a full year, Yash for a week, Noel for several scattered weekends, and Angela for 2 months. All the girls had taken their turns with Julian, including Angela. Sebastian, too, had a dalliance. Angela had a tender, brief kiss with Yash their first year, and then dated Noel for much of the second year. It was like a logic puzzle keeping it all straight. They often couldn't do it themselves and would forget who was with who, or they would at least pretend to. This friction is what made the Nine what they were, webbed together by a meshed network of nerves and veins, reacting to each other's pain and pleasure. They were an organic soap opera with 18 swinging arms. The tension and the drama was part of what made it all work. Peter wasn't handsome in the way Julian was. Few people were. He wasn't romantic like Yash, or rubbery and goofy like Noel, with his 70s clothes and spindly energy. Peter was thoughtful, with heavy-lidded eyes that missed nothing. Suze had only good things to say about his physical attributes, and Suze was nothing if not forthcoming. He had a broad, athletic build, a soft flop of coppery hair. But the sexiest thing about him was that he was funny. The funniest of them all, really. But that was something you only came to understand over time. Peter wasn't one for the witty exchanges like Sebastian, or physical gestures like Noel or Yash. He was quiet. He saved it, wrote it all down, refined it. She wanted to say something to Peter about her growing fear of the future, of being without the rest of them, of all the changes, of not being flanked by the Nine at all times. She wanted to grab him and press her face into his chest. She wanted to hold on to all her friends and never, ever let them go, and from the look on his face, he felt exactly as she did. There was a flash of light followed by a tremendous crack in the distance. The sky opened and the rain came all at once. Instead of taking this moment for its romantic value and inviting Peter to meet her right now on the floor, what she said was, "Do you think we'll still play?" And that was that. All the tension dispersed. His whole demeanor changed. She had ruined the moment.
"I'm sure we will,"
he said, handing the lighter back to her.
"See you downstairs."
He left Angela alone with her dreary thoughts, plus a bonus of embarrassment and disappointment. She needed to get herself together. This misery wouldn't do.
This week was going to be incredible, the most fun they'd ever had, and they'd had a lot of fun. She would make a point of revisiting the moment with Peter. Maybe that would be her project for the week. She distracted herself by going to the mirror to examine the bald girl who looked back at her. She still wasn't used to it, even after 2 weeks. Angela hadn't meant to cut off all her hair. She had simply woken up one morning with vague memories of a game of truth or dare, and all her hair was in the kitchen sink. She laughed in front of the others and cried in her room. Not because she hated it, but because she didn't recognize herself. It wasn't so bad. Maybe she loved it. It was tough, decisive. There was a little hair sprouting now, a soft fuzz. She liked the way it felt. Another knock. This time, the door opened before she could call out. Rosie popped in.
"Ange," she said in a low voice, shutting the door behind her. "I need to talk to you for a moment."
"What's Jules done?"
"Not everything is about Julian," Rosie replied, shutting the door. "Jesus."
"Tell that to him. He'll faint from shock."
Usually, Rosie would flop back on the bed to have a chat. Tonight, she sat on the edge, her expression grave.
"What's wrong?" Angela asked. "Are you all right?"
"I don't know. I mean, I'm fine. It's just, I saw something. Something I didn't understand, but I think I might understand it now. It was in the paper, and now that I've seen the photos..."
"What are you on about?"
Angela said, sitting next to her.
"You won't believe me," Rosie said. "I don't believe me."
Before Rosie could say anything else, there was another knock and Suze joined them. She had a bottle of champagne and 3 water tumblers tucked under her arm. Rosie shook her head at Angela, indicating that she should say nothing about the conversation they'd been having.
"I'm furious at you," Suze said to her friends.
"What?" Angela said.
"Why?"
"You don't have a drink. Sebastian's family left us 6 crates of what he's calling third-rate champers, which means it's better than anything we've had in a while. You look sad, and I won't have it. Julian's caused enough trouble."
Rosie put her hands over her face and stifled a scream. Suze popped open the champagne, causing it to foam up and spill onto the bedspread. She filled the tumblers and passed them out. The warm champagne went right to Angela's brain, creating a pleasant warm fizz behind her eyes.
"No long faces," Suze said. "This week is for us, and we're going to have a good time. Now drink up like good girls and come with me. Anyway, it's time to play the game."
Whatever Rosie had been about to say, she had decided to hold for the time being. Much as they all loved Suze, everyone knew she wasn't great at secrets. She didn't seem to believe in them as a concept. Everything was to be shared. Her possessions, her thoughts, her body. It's what made her such a good performer and generous friend, and what made her a bit of a nightmare if you were trying to keep something to yourself.
"You're right," Rosie said. "Let's go and play the game."
"There's a good girl. Come on, let's go."
As they followed Suze out of the bedroom into the dark hall, Rosie gave Angela a tug on the arm to hold her back for a moment.
"I'll talk to you after,"
Rosie said to Angela quietly.
"Come up and meet me here after the game."
"But what's it about? What's going on?"
Rosie shook her head.
"Not now," she replied. "It's too important."
Over the years, these words would replay in Angela's head. If only she had pulled Rosie back into that bedroom, waited a few more minutes to go downstairs, sat her back down on the wet bedspread and made her explain. If only she'd listened to her gut for once, maybe things wouldn't have happened the way they did. Her life, all their lives, would have been different. But Angela did not do that. She followed Suze and Rosie down the steps of Merriweather, past the family portraits and the landscapes, to where the others were waiting. Events spun on toward the inevitable. 2. Back in her room, Stevie sat on her bed and gnawed on a piece of the chocolate cake she had acquired. The first bite revealed a terrible but inevitable fact. It had maple in it. In Vermont, there is maple syrup in it. It doesn't matter what it is. Cake, ice cream, coffee,
soup, mustard, concrete, the water supply. This chocolate maple cake was way too sweet, but it was in her mouth now. There's no going back with cake. She crinkled her nose from the cloying taste and took another swing at the reading. Defining bias, how we interpret what we read. When we consider the topic of bias, we must first consider the writer. And to consider the writer, we must consider the audience. Stevie sighed and looked at the ceiling, concentrating on the rosette that housed the overhead light. The heat clanged through the radiator. It was so hot. She got up and opened her window a few inches, went over and rearranged some things on her bureau, and picked up the phone she had put there to keep it out of her hands while she was doing homework. No messages, nothing to distract her. She set the phone down and looked at herself in the mirror. Her hair was getting weird. She'd meant to get it cut over the summer, but forgot. So now she had a blonde demi-shag. She'd tried to cut it herself earlier in the semester, but Janelle told her it was great. Stevie relied on Janelle for this kind of advice because Janelle understood clothes and hair. This knowledge Jean had skipped Stevie. She didn't get how she was supposed to look. All she knew was the black hoodie that comprised 90% of her personal style and the vintage red vinyl raincoat that made up the other 10%. She owned a little makeup, a massive eyeshadow palette Janelle had given her for her birthday, a lip gloss, some kind of highlighter in a tube. She picked up the latter and began to apply it to the high point of her cheekbones. Her face was round. This highlighter was supposed to do something about that. It was sticky, and now she had shiny lines under her eyes. She would watch a video. She would learn how to do this. What if she gave herself bangs? She could give herself bangs. She went over to her desk to look for scissors, then remembered that Janelle had taken her scissors 2 weeks before because Stevie had said something out loud about maybe giving herself bangs. Nate was right. She had become the person with the long-distance boyfriend. There was a David-sized hole in everything. They texted constantly and spoke at least once every day, but that didn't make up for the fact that he was in England doing his first semester of college in London, and England is far from Vermont. He was 5 hours ahead, so he tended to talk to Stevie throughout the day, and then between 6 and 8 o'clock for their long call of the day, which meant she had the rest of her night to stare slack-jawed at her friends and not get any work done. She hated being this person, but she didn't know how to make it stop. Her feelings rolled over her thoughts. Being in love had killed her brain. She needed to focus. She had to read this goddamn thing. She returned to her bed and picked up her computer to try again. Defining bias. How we interpret what we read. She seemed to be constitutionally unable to read the first paragraph. It was like there was a force field around it. She knew exactly when she would be able to read it. On her phone, on the way to class, in a panic. Why was she like this? Other people seemed to be able to do stuff in a reasonable fashion. Some had detailed online calendars. Others, like Janelle, kept fancy planners that they marked up with special pens and stickers. Some people simply knew what they were supposed to be doing and did it. And those people were the worst of all. Stevie's brain had to hit a white-hot pitch of panic before it was willing to do any real work. It would work quickly then. It was a good brain, but it had only two modes, fog and frenzy. Maybe she could cut her hair with nail clippers. It would be slow, but it could be done. Oh my God, she said out loud. Defining bias. How we... Stevie gagged on cake when her laptop unexpectedly made a ringing noise. David's name and the video call icon popped up on her screen. She had crumbs on her face, and her teeth were probably covered in dark brown cake jackets. She rubbed her face and ran her tongue over her teeth before answering. "You're calling late," she said.
"It's never too late for my princess."
David was leaning against a fake wood headboard and looked down at the camera, in that angle that was flattering to no one except maybe to adorably jowly dogs and to David. "Are you drunk?"
"Not drunk," he said. "Just hanging out with some people. I had 2 beers, maybe 3. I had 4 beers. So, those 5 beers I had.
God, he was handsome. He was sexy. Whatever sexy was, David was that. He was loose, curly hair, long-limbed and comfortable in his skin. When Stevie had arrived at Ellingham the year before, David had been the school's most famous reprobate, rumored to be drunk or high most of the time. His reputation was exaggerated, but still, he was the kind of guy who always had weed somewhere nearby and wasn't going to turn down a drink. He attended classes on a need-to-know basis, with the criteria being what he felt he needed to know and when he thought he needed to know it, which was not much and maybe later. His greatest performances on campus included sleeping on the roof, 5 a.m. screaming meditations, sleeping in class in a Pokemon comforter, and releasing several dozen squirrels in the library. After he left, after he was removed from school, he completely cleaned up his act. He finished school remotely with high grades, graduated, and spent the summer working to register voters. He was a model citizen now, and even in England, where you could legally drink when you were 18, he never seemed to do so. Most nights, when he was on video calls with Stevie, he was stone-cold sober and working. She liked slightly drunk David. She had missed him.
So here's the thing, he said.
Stevie's stomach contracted itself into a tiny, hard fist. It was reflexive. Every hanging sentence burned along her nervous system. This was when he told her he'd met someone in England. Someone smart and funny with an accent who raised horses or something. What? She said when he trailed off. What?
You're pretty. And you've got a shiny face.
Her adrenaline levels dropped, but her heart was still pounding and her stomach churning. She rubbed at the highlighter with the back of her fist. What? She said again.
God. Okay. So I was thinking. You know how I'm here and you're there?
Stevie nodded and gestured with her hand that he should get to the point.
Well, it's not good, right? So I was thinking. Do you want to come here?
What?
Do you want to come here?
I heard you, she said. And of course I want to go there, but I can't.
Why not?
Because. It wasn't that she didn't want to go. Of course she wanted to go. Everyone wanted to go to England. And she especially wanted to go to England, but it wasn't possible. She didn't have a clear answer on why it wasn't possible, but it was something, something, school life, something.
Okay, but here's the thing.
He slid down the headboard a bit and had to straighten up, putting the laptop on his knees and changing the view.
I was talking to the people who brought me here, and I was saying that you should come here too, because you should, and they said they would talk to someone at the American Embassy who works in educational tourism or something, and he just got back to me, and you're a pretty little starfish.
What?
Okay. You wouldn't stay in my building, but they have some rooms in the building connected to this one. They said they could get up to 4 rooms for a week or 10 days or something, and you could call it study abroad or something. Like, you'd have someone to call at the embassy, so if Quinn gets up your ass about it.
Wait, you got 4 rooms?
For you. And for Nate and Janelle and Vi, because I know that is how this would work. You just...
He gestured expansively and knocked the computer off his knees. She was looking at the ceiling for a moment before he righted it.
Study abroad thing. This guy can help with that. You tell the school you're looking at museums or some shit, and you come here.
Stevie was so distracted that she set her cake on the front of her hoodie by her collarbone. I need a passport. Don't I? I don't have one.
You can get one. It doesn't take that long. Just come here, stop being a dick about not being here right now, and come here. There's, like, a queen. So, come here. Just do it. Come on.
Stevie didn't precisely rip Janelle's door off the hinges a few minutes later, but there was a bit of violence inflicted on it. While Janelle called Vi, Stevie ran to the end of the hall and rattled Nate's doorknob. He didn't answer, so she texted him until the door cracked open and he peered out. Everyone wanted to go to England. Stevie woke the next morning assuming that everything she remembered about the conversation was a dream. But there were multiple messages from David waiting for her. A name, an email, a phone number, the address of a building in London. It was a genuine offer with a genuine person at the American Embassy prepared to back it up. She spent every moment between classes and lab and yoga looking up flights and passport information. She had some money, the result of work she had done over the summer with a guy named Carson, who ran a company called Boxbox and wanted to make a true crime podcast. She'd been undercover at the summer camp he'd bought and helped him solve the cold case of the box in the woods. He'd paid her decently for her time at the camp. Plus, he'd advanced her some money while he put together the podcast about the case. It wasn't a fortune, but it was way more than she'd ever had before, working at the mall or the grocery store. She could buy a fancy coffee every once in a while, and she had invested in some new black hoodies. There was enough for a plane ticket, plus a little pocket cash for each day to pay for food and things. Over dinner that night at the dining hall, maple-glazed pork with mashed sweet potatoes with a little bit of maple syrup in them, the four set about creating their presentation, their pitch to Ellingham about why they should be permitted to go to London. There aren't many advantages to having a bunch of murders happen at your school. They tend to bring down the mood. However, in the search for silver linings, there was one. The school had fully embraced the concept of remote learning. Before, Ellingham expected its students to be there all the time, going to class and being part of the school community and that kind of thing. But once the murders started, they decided to get a bit more flexible. It turned out you could do a lot of school stuff outside of school. Ellingham still wanted you to go to class, but if people had to travel home or go on college visits or do a project somewhere, there were far more opportunities to do so. You could join your class remotely. It took about 4 hours and many cups of coffee, but by the end of the night, they had collectively hammered out something that looked like a legitimate case, a detailed day-by-day schedule in spreadsheet format, listing cultural and historical locations of interest and what they intended to do there, and how this related to their individual academic goals. They reviewed the plan until midnight, at which point they emailed it to Dr. Quinn, the head of school. They weren't expecting anything else to happen until tomorrow, but she replied within 10 minutes to everyone with the following words. "My office, tomorrow, 6 p.m. Stevie was going to England. Maybe. If Dr. Quinn said it was okay, which was not a guarantee, because of things like the murders and Stevie's propensity to get involved in them. She just needed a yes. June 23rd, 1995. 11 p.m.
"There you are, my darlings," Sebastian said as Suze shepherded Angela into the sitting room.
He popped a bottle of champagne and put the foaming mess to his lips. Some of it made it inside his mouth. The rest went down the slim-fitting deep purple shirt he was wearing. He used his champagne sticky hand to sweep his dyed black hair back off his face.
"We're seriously going to play when it's pissing down?"
Yash said from the sofa.
"Of course," Sebastian intoned. "We are not cowards. Don't speak for me."
Angela sat next to Yash, sinking deep into the cushions. This was a proper old sitting room sofa, the kind that enfolded you in soft, flocked fabric and broken-down filling, inviting you to stay for hour after hour, drinking and reading and enjoying the fire.
"We could stay inside," Yash said. "Like normal people, we could drink." "Sounds like someone's worried,"
Peter said, coming into the room with a tarnished horn he'd picked up from one of Meriwether's countless displays of antiquities. He tooted it speculatively, but it only made a spluttering fart noise.
"I don't even know why we have to play this game every time we're here,"
Yash went on.
"Tradition,"
Sebastian said.
"How's it a tradition if we've only been here 3 times? That's not even a habit. It barely qualifies as a trend."
Noel threw himself over the back of the sofa and slid down between Yash and Angela. Noel rejoiced in weird movements and liked to throw himself around the furniture, down the stairs, up into the rafters.
"Now,"
Sebastian said as he grabbed a bag and began distributing small packages containing disposable clear rain ponchos.
I'm the starting seeker. I'll count to 100 to give you all time. As I find you, you'll join the seeker team. I'll give you a yellow poncho to show you've switched sides.
He held up a yellow poncho as an example.
When you find people, bring them to me for the poncho. Oh, and don't even bother with the outbuildings.
He reached down into the front of his trousers and fished around for a moment.
The evening has taken a turn, Yash said. It's a bit early to get your cock out, Sebastian, even for you.
Sebastian jerked his arm up and triumphantly displayed a set of keys.
Everything's locked, and these are the only keys.
He held them aloft, stared at them for a moment, as if he wanted to question them about the nature of keys and locks and how they fit into the grand plan of the universe, then shoved them back down the front of his trousers with a roughness that made everyone wince.
There,
Sebastian went on, wobbling a bit.
The keys are now down with the other family treasures.
Why?
Yash said. Why there? Didn't fit in the pocket. Throws off the line of the trousers. So, no outbuildings. The boundaries are anything within the proper grounds. The house, any of the gardens, any wooded area within the stone boundary wall, and nothing beyond